From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen talks about his new novel, The Corrections. It's a literary and popular success. Last week, it was nominated for a National Book Award. It's also number one on the bestseller list. It's an intricate and satirical story about a family, three adult children who live far away from their parents. Their father has developed Parkinson's disease and is too sick to take care of himself. Also, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word infidel and the language of religious fundamentalism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Sky of Stone, the sequel to the memoir October Sky by Homer Hickam.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been focusing most of our programs on terrorism, but we don't want to completely lose track of what's happening in the arts. So today we're going to talk about a terrific new novel. My guest, Jonathan Franzen, is the author of The Corrections, one of those rare books which is both a literary and a popular success. It received mostly rave reviews. The New York Times Sunday Book Review said that its wordplay was worthy of Nabokov. Last week, The Corrections was nominated for a National Book Award. It's also the current Oprah Book Club selection, which has helped it reach number one on the bestseller list. The story revolves around the lives of three adult children who live far away from their aging parents. The parents' health problems have made it difficult to keep taking care of themselves, and the children have to decide how much they're willing to change their own lives to care for their parents. But the novel is also a satire about family dysfunction, work, postmodernism, and trendy transgressive art. Recently, Franzen wrote a short piece for The New Yorker about his response to September 11th. I asked him what it's like to be a novelist now.
In a larger sense, if you're talking about what the fiction writer's responsibilities might be or chosen responsibility might be, in good times, you know, remind people of darkness, remind yourself of darkness, remind yourself that there's a world out there that that is unhappy, remind yourself that death exists, and then in dark times, try to remember, you know, the comedy and the ridiculousness of things. And I think that was really more the spirit of what I was saying in at the end of that New Yorker piece.
Yeah, you know, I read your book before September 11th and really loved it. And it was getting great reviews. And I thought, wow, this time around, his book's really going to take off. And then after the 11th, I thought, well, that's really a shame. That book will probably get lost because people are so obsessed now with what's happening in the world and with the uncertainty of the world. And yet the book became a bestseller, and Oprah picked it up for her book club. Have you felt that your novel or that fiction in general matters any less right now?
Well, does it? I mean, mattering is not a day-by-day thing. And so the quick answer would be no, of course not. If you look in any time scale larger than the few weeks immediately following a national calamity, I don't think it does. I do feel as if the way it's read inevitably changes when the tenor of the times change. It's of some satisfaction to me that people still seem to find something in it, even though the tenor of the times more or less flipped overnight. Mm-hmm. We had been drifting towards a recession, but it was still basically a blissful, isolated time for us all here in the country, and now we're in a very different place. That goes back to that my remark about what I think what my chosen responsibility as a writer is, which is to create stuff that if you're reading it when things are good in your life, provide some company for you in contemplating the fact that things won't always be good. But also, if you're reading it at a bad time in your life, to you know, kind of lend a helping hand there too, and show that, well, even when things are bad, things can be awfully funny or full of meaning. And evidently, you know, this particular book has managed to bridge those two sides of September 11th. We'll see if that lasts.
In an earlier essay you wrote that most fiction readers are women. You said writers like Jane Smiley and Amy Tan are confident of an attentive audience, whereas all the male novelists that you know, including yourself, are clueless as to who could possibly be buying your books. Were you surprised when Oprah chose your novel, The Corrections, as her book club selection?
It went beyond, I guess surprise is a word. It was so unexpected that I was almost not surprised. It was like, oh, hey, Oprah, thank you for calling. Yeah, oh, that's nice. And I put down the phone because it literally had never once crossed my mind that this might be an Oprah pick, partly because she seldom chooses hardcovers, partly because she does choose a lot of female authors. And partly because, as you know, the reviewer in the New York Times said, this feels too edgy to ever be an Oprah pick. And so it never occurred to me. It has been a source of pain that there are interesting male novelists out there, and I'll just leave myself out of the statement for the moment, who don't find an audience because they don't find a female audience. Because that is, I mean, so much of reading is sustained in this country, I think, by the fact that women read while men are off golfing or watching football on TV or, playing with their flight simulator or whatever. I continue to believe that. And now I'm actually at the point with this book where I worry, I'm sorry that it's, I had some hope of actually reaching a male audience. And I've heard more than one reader in signing lines now in bookstores say, if I hadn't heard you, I would have been put off by the fact that it is an Oprah pick. I figure those books are for women, and I would never touch it. Those are male readers speaking. So I'm a little confused about the whole thing right now.
I wonder if you've been, if you feel like you've reached a lot of readers that ordinarily wouldn't have found your book, and if in doing so you've gotten interpretations of your book that are surprising?
It is, first and foremost, it's a literary book, and I think it's an accessible literary book. It's an open question how big the audience is to which it will be accessible, and I think beyond the limits of that audience, there's going to be a lot of what was Oprah thinking kind of responses. They themselves over there at the Oprah show they have no idea how they're going to arrange the show because they've never done a book like this and they're waiting to hear from their readers.
So you haven't actually done the show yet? The readers are supposed to be, the book club readers are supposed to be reading it now, but the show addressing it hasn't happened?
Right. I've done the sort of bogus thing where they follow you around with a camera and you try to look natural. And I've done a two-hour interview, which will be boiled down to 3 minutes or so. But they know the show with which I've never seen until they sent me a tape. The little coffee klatch and then the full audience stuff, that has not happened. Won't happen until November.
Well, Jonathan Franzen, I'd like you to read a section from the beginning of The Corrections, and maybe you could just introduce this part for us.
I hope it needs not very much introduction because it is the beginning of the first real chapter of the book. But it's about the stress of a wannabe hipster who's too old really to be a hipster as his Midwestern parents arrive in New York City. Down the long concourse, they came unsteadily, Enid favoring her damaged hip, Alfred paddling at the air with loose-hinged hands and slapping the airport carpeting with poorly controlled feet, both of them carrying Nordic Pleasure Line's shoulder bags and concentrating on the floor in front of them, measuring out the hazardous distance 3 paces at a time. To anyone who saw them averting their eyes from the dark-haired New Yorkers careering past them, to anyone who caught a glimpse of Alfred's straw fedora looming at the height of Iowa corn on Labor Day, or the yellow wool of the slack stretching over Enid's outslung hip, it was obvious that they were Midwestern and intimidated. But to Chip Lambert, who was waiting for them just beyond the security checkpoint, they were killers. Chip had crossed his arms defensively and raised one hand to pull on the wrought iron rivet in his ear. He worried that he might tear the rivet right out of his earlobe, that the maximum pain his ear's nerves could generate was less pain than he needed now to steady himself. From his position by the metal detectors, he watched an azure-haired girl overtake his parents, an azure-haired girl of college age, a very wantable stranger with pierced lips and eyebrows. It struck him that if he could have sex with this girl for 1 second, he could face his parents confidently. And that if he could keep on having sex with this girl once every minute for as long as his parents were in town, he could survive their entire visit. Chip was a tall, gym-built man with crow's feet and sparse, butter-yellow hair. If the girl had noticed him, she might have thought he was a little too old for the leather he was wearing. As she hurried past him, he pulled harder on his rivet to offset the pain of her departure from his life forever and to focus his attention on his father, whose face was brightening at the discovery of a son among so many strangers. In the lunging manner of a man floundering in water, Alfred fell upon Chip and grabbed Chip's hand and wrist as if they were a rope he'd been thrown. "Well," he said, "well." Enid came limping up behind him. "Chip," she cried, "what have you done to your ears?" "Dad, Mom," Chip murmured through his teeth, hoping the azure-haired girl was out of earshot. "Good to see you."
You know, the book is in part about that moment in an adult's life when they see their parents go from this kind of almost threatening presence, a controlling presence, to being people who are very weak and very much in need of help from their children, as opposed to people who are trying to control their children. What made you focus on that transition, that realization in your book?
Well, part of it grew out of my own experience, and I'm guessing you'll have a question or two along those lines.
He said resentfully.
No. No, I don't watch Oprah, but I do listen to your show. So let me leapfrog over that to some of the more thematic reasons why I was attracted
Good.
To that.
Okay.
It seems I grew up feeling like I was a child and adults were adults. And I seem to have grown into a time and a place where people don't really want to be adults in the same way I understood them to be, which was well-mannered people who dress differently than children and who, you know, were in some way put their children's interests before their own. And all around just were of a different class. They liked being adults. They got a satisfaction from that. And ever since the boomer generation faced the problem of adulthood with kind of dubious results, and since so much of commercial culture has come to focus on the 18 to 34 demographic, it seems as if adulthood itself is to some extent a threatened commodity. And yet there is this feeling in the back of one's head, well, there are those parents, and I get to be a child even up into my 40s, 50s, and 60s because those parents are there. And it seemed to me an interesting question of to look at. What happens when you do finally lose those parents and you're next in line? That's an interesting question for me, and it goes to some of the more culturally critical undercurrents in the book.
Could you have written this novel only after the death of your parents? Would you have feared that the novel would have some way hurt them, or they would have felt betrayed by it, thinking that a lot of the characterizations in them were really about them?
Or about them and their friends, about their cohort, certainly, which is what this is drawn from. It's not per se a portrait of my parents. It's more a portrait of a type that my parents were one instance of that I saw a lot of when I was growing up in the Midwest. You know, my father was unhappy with certain things in my second book. He felt, I think, betrayed by what he perceived as a criticism of religion, when in fact, I don't think there is one there. My mother had, by that point, long since learned how to read my books without reading them and how to skim the cream off the experience of my being a writer without actually having to, you know, down the milk underneath it. And she was alive as various pieces of this book were being published in magazines to which she had access. And it was interesting to see how she responded to that. She, in one instance, asked me to give a paragraph-by-paragraph synopsis, or accepted my offer to give a paragraph-by-paragraph synopsis of a chunk of this that was in The New Yorker, just so she didn't have to cast her eyes over it herself. And I think, you know, my father was a stricter person, and I think might have been more prone to make moral judgments. My mother, at that point in her life, really was bent on getting along with her kids and would have let nothing stop that. And I indeed wrote much of it when she was still alive and with the hope that she would be alive to see it published.
My guest is Jonathan Franzen, author of the best-selling novel The Corrections. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You've been tuning to Public Radio to keep up to date on the war against terrorism and to learn about what else is happening in the world, from politics to the arts. Although we know there's a lot on your mind right now, we're going to ask you to make a pledge to support Public Radio, because without your pledge, we couldn't continue to bring you the news, analysis, and reflection that you want and need. Thank you so much for your support. Jonathan Franzen is my guest. He's the author of the new best-selling novel, The Corrections. Your novel keeps shifting points, point of view. It's written from the point of view of each of the three adult children in this family, as well as from the point of view as the mother and father. What are some of the things you were trying to do novelistically in having the point of view keep changing?
Well, that seems to be a fixture of all my books. And I think it gets it comes from the essential blurriness of my own nature. I don't seem to be able to be the same person on any two consecutive days, whether in as straightforward a way as the fact that I'm moody and, you know, kind of fairly elated one day and then anxious and gloomy the next, to the fact that I feel like at once a 12-year-old boy and a 78-year-old man and a 42-year-old man and a 32-year-old woman. I just, it grows out of my own sense of having a multitude of voices in myself and being unwilling or perhaps unable to settle on any single one of them. There are really two kinds of writers, I think, in that regard. There are the ventriloquists or the empaths, which is what I think I am, and then there are the people who have a strong, really, really strong native voice and who will do everything in their own voice. And probably it's a good idea for me to keep trying to do that, because I don't know if I will ever be able to settle on a single voice.
Is that ability to see many different points of view simultaneously ever paralyzing in real life, when you have to be decisive and figure out which one direction or which one to head in or which one point of view to have?
You could ask any of my friends or anyone in my family that question and they would all start laughing. No, I'm kind of classically paralytic as far as I seem to just find myself again and again in every way in situations of conflict and ambivalence and paralysis. And yeah, so it's debilitating in a life way, but it's fun on the page, and that's
right.
That's probably what makes me a writer.
Can you talk about some of the things you were trying with the tone of your book? Again, you know, some of your narration is from the point of view of someone who's very ironic. Of course, when the point of view is from the mother's point of view, she's very sentimental and not ironic at all. So the actual tone keeps shifting. Some of it is really very funny in a very kind of dark, cynical way, and other parts aren't like that at all.
Well, I like heterogeneity. I like cities. I like walking down a street and having the scene change from block to block. I'm attracted to Stravinsky, who will go from tuneful to assonant and back to tuneful. And I'm, you know, that's that, I mean, it's a taste matter to some extent. that drives me to use all the tones I have at my command. I think in general there is an overarching comic tone to it. At least that's how I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that is an antidote. That is my own antidote to my own tendency to write in either shame-ridden confessional styles, or worse yet, in a very, very self-important, earnest style. And when I pick up a book that has that tone of high earnestness, I will usually not read past about page 5.
You know, there's the character, the son Chip, in your novel, writes for a little journal that's called the Warren Street Journal, and it's a kind of journal of transgressive culture. And he says that at the offices of the journal, he sometimes felt insufficiently transgressive, as if his innermost self were still a nice Midwestern boy. Is that something you felt about yourself, that your innermost self was a nice Midwestern boy, and that you had to put on these transgressive clothes to kind of cover that up?
Yes and no. I mean, in some senses, that sentence could describe me. In others, in other respects, though, that would appear to discount the sincerity or the intensity of the anger I felt about the way our culture was set up when I was writing my first two books. For Chip, it manifests as a sense of fraudulence. For me, it manifests as a tension. I am both a nice Midwestern boy and somebody who is thinking hard about the way we live and the reasons we live that way. Chip is not me, but I certainly sympathize with that particular moment, that spasm of fraudulent feeling that he has.
Jonathan Franzen is the author of the new novel, The Corrections. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jonathan Franzen about his new best-selling novel, The Corrections. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word infidel and the language of religious fundamentalism.
Major support for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Support also comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Franzen, author of the new novel, The Corrections. It's a literary and popular success. Last week, it was nominated for a National Book Award. It's currently number 1 on the bestseller list. The novel is about three adult children and their two aging parents who are having difficulty taking care of themselves. The father has Parkinson's disease. The novel is also a satire of contemporary family life, work, and lifestyles. The mother in your novel is very sentimental, whether it's planning for Thanksgiving or the kind of way she'll arrange the house. And it sounds like your real mother, from the little I've read about her, was a pretty sentimental person, too. I'm wondering how that affected your taste as a writer and reader and person to come from somebody who is pretty sentimental and not ironic.
Well, you could certainly draw parallels between the disastrously bad relations between me and my mother for, about 20 years, starting at age 13, and the fact that I wrote two kind of harder-edged books that were at pains to avoid any possible threat or hint of sentimentality, and the fact that as she and I got closer towards the end of her life, I became more comfortable with writing about stuff that might be potentially perceived as sentimental. No contest on that one.
The father in the novel is taking medication for Parkinson's disease that causes him to hallucinate. And your father had hallucinations too, first from medicine and then problems because of the Alzheimer's disease. And both your father and the father in the novel were very straight-laced people.
Safe to say straight-laced, yes.
Yeah. So I'm wondering what it was like to see someone very straight-laced losing control, both physically but also in terms of their inner life, these hallucinations and delusions.
Well, I think when it was happening to my father, it was awful. I felt for him terribly because I knew that he really, again, like a lot of men of that generation, his manhood in part consisted of his self-control and ability to contain himself. And as he began to lose that, it was really terrible for him. At the same time, because he was so distant, I kept hoping that, first of all, I had a hard time admitting what was really going on. And I kept hoping that this would lead perhaps to a breaking down of the boundaries that had separated us and that we really could be close in a way that he had never been able to be before. Unfortunately, that proved not really to be the case. By the time the boundaries were down far enough for that to happen, there wasn't much left on his side of the boundary.
You know, in the piece you wrote about your father's Alzheimer's disease in The New Yorker, you said that watching your father lose his intelligence, sanity, and self-consciousness, you found yourself becoming less afraid of losing those abilities yourself. You became a little less afraid in general. I really wanted to know why. I mean, because so often it's the other way around. You see somebody you love deteriorate, and you really worry about your own future.
Well, again, I was a very old 8-year-old. I really meant it when I say, well, as Lydia Davis, in a famous, very short story of hers, says, you know, there was a young woman who considered herself an old woman, and she would ask herself, why are these young men flirting with this old lady? You know, I identified so much with my parents that I was always their age. And one thing that happened was that when they got sick and died, I couldn't identify with them anymore. I was actually freed to be my own real age. Beyond that, I think you know that people close to you are going to die, and you live in fear of that, especially if they're as important to you as my parents were to me. And realizing that I could walk into a room with my father, you know, raving mad, or walk into a room where he was barely breathing and near death, that here comes this thing which is unimaginable, that I'm terrified of, and yet I'm going through it. In a way, I projected, or I translated that directly onto what he was going through. That is, it had been, you know, it was unimaginable, obviously, to him as to all of us. Like, how am I going to get through death? And to see that this one terrifying unimaginable thing that I've been imagining or I'd been facing and fearing indeed could be traversed did make me less afraid of other painful possibilities of in the future, including losing those various things.
And there's something you write about your father's actual death. You say, "I don't like to remember how impatient I was for my father's breathing to stop, how ready to be free of him I was."
Well, I think that goes back to the idea of a very disciplined person letting go. Interestingly, I felt that I myself was a supremely disciplined writer. You know, I would have 6 to 10 cigarettes a day. I would sit down at 9 in the morning and I would write until 5. And I produced these very together novels, these two books that I found rather unassailable, at least emotionally. And yet, as he was falling apart, I was realizing that old kind of all-controlling way of writing was just no longer working for me, and that I needed, however scary the prospect was, I needed to let go of something as a writer. I needed to fall apart a little bit myself. And again, you know, when it was clear he was going to die, it was just a matter of, you know, is it going to be at 9 o'clock or at 12 o'clock? I did feel this building sense of exhilaration to be free, first of all, of this week-long vigil that my mother and I had been sitting, and also to you know, get on with being my own person and to let go and do that after that strong father was gone.
Did it take a lot of courage to write that sentence?
Oh, you can't ask others to congratulate themselves for their
right,
courage.
Right, okay, yeah. Well, you know what I mean. Was it hard to say that in public? Because it could so easily be misunderstood.
Here's the way it really works. With that piece I wrote, it was more or less assigned as a book piece about David Schenck's new book about Alzheimer's, a very good book called The Forgetting. And when I sat down to do an outline, I realized, you know, what I'm really interested here is talking about my father and what happened to him, and the way in which I remember it and the way in which his memory was going, and have it be sort of a meditation on memory in general. So I sat down to write it and trusted that my editor would take out anything that was too compromising personally. And when it was closed, I felt this panic. I thought, oh my God, I should not have published this. This is a terrible thing to have done. It's so exposing. And I actually was thinking it was more in terms of how exposing it was of my parents, even though they're no longer here. It's more like jumping off the diving board happily, because I enjoy jumping off the diving board, and then worrying right before I hit the water, like, oh, this is really going to be painful.
You know, sometimes our self-image is tied to the way other people see us, you know, to the mirrors they hold up to us. And a lot of that has to do with how our parents saw us when we were coming of age. That sticks with you a long time. How did it affect your image of yourself to have your father forget who you were or mistake you for somebody else? And so, like, the mirror he's holding up to you is, like, the wrong image.
Well, that was nothing new. I had been mistaken for a lot of things by both my parents before that happened. I'd been mistaken for a budding young scientist or engineer or a possible lawyer or possible banker or possible international journalist. That sense of not being known for myself came to me at the age of about 7, and indeed is probably at the center of why I write. It's to try to say over and over again, no, I'm not that, I'm this. But that is, of course, the paradox of Alzheimer's. They talk about, you know, the sufferer losing himself, but what's in fact happening is that the people around him are losing themselves with respect to the mirror that the sufferer is holding up.
My guest is Jonathan Franzen, author of the new novel, The Corrections. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Franzen, author of the new novel, The Corrections. As I think I've mentioned, I really like your novel, The Corrections, a lot. And I think part of the problem I knew I would encounter in interviewing you is that the story in the novel has a lot to do with relationships and the kind of psychological connections between people. The tone of the novel is great because of how the tone keeps shifting from person to person, and your terrific use of language and the type of humor that you put into it. But my fear was, and perhaps I've sadly succeeded in doing this, that I would end up reducing some of your novel to this kind of psychopathology, because things are hard to talk about sometimes and to maintain the tone that your novel does while talking about it. But I figure I'm not the only one who's going to be pushing you into that particular corner. You're being interviewed a lot, and probably a lot of people like myself are trying to turn your novel into a personal introspection, or, you know, at the worst end of it, some kind of psychobabble. So has it been hard for you? And I offer myself as one of the guilty parties here. I mean, I've tried my best, but I know I'm going to end up being a little reductionist in the way I treat it.
Well, it's part of a problem I've been experiencing again and again as I've been out on this book tour. I'm not very interesting. I mean, really I'm not. Or you know, if you spend a day with me, you might find me interesting if you're so inclined. But I really, really work hard on trying to make a book work and be full and entertaining. And I feel as if the book is having this success, and then people turn to me and say, "Well, you know, if Lou Reed cuts a record, or if Bob Dylan cuts a record, you listen to the music, and then you look at the guy who cut the record, and you can see, you know, that they're more or less identical." Here, it's like I worked for many years to find that tone for the book, and I worked for many years to come up with a structure that would make the book really, really work. And yet that's intrinsically uninteresting material. So there is this kind of, okay, well, let's talk about the person then. And then I sort of trot out my my really rather ordinary life experiences and feel as if I'm a disappointment. That's the chief nature of. I mean, I understand you have to do an interview, and I understand an author interview is a brutally hard thing to do for a fiction writer, at any rate. And I probably am not alone among fiction writers in feeling like I wish I had something more interesting to say, but the book is where it's at. The author is not.
Well, Jonathan Franzen, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for talking to me.
Jonathan Franzen is the author of the new novel, The Corrections. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to the way people translate the language of Islamic fundamentalism, and he's thinking about why it has such a medieval sound to American ears. Jeff wonders if it's possible to translate between secular and religious cultures, or if this is just a gulf that language can't span.
Listening to the video of Osama bin Laden that was released after the U.S. began its attack on Afghanistan, I was struck by the way the interpreter had him calling President Bush the head of the infidels and insisting that the army of infidels must leave the land of Muhammad. Infidel is such a quaint word in English that I wondered whether it was a fair translation. With the help of an Egyptian colleague, I checked out the Arabic version of bin Laden's message. He had used the word kafir, which does indeed translate as infidel. Kafir is one of those elastic terms that can stretch from out-and-out heathens to the heretics in the apartment upstairs. But in its strict meaning, kafir refers to non-Muslims, particularly when they're considered confrontationally. Muslim scholars divide the world between the Dar al-Kufr, the land of the kafirs, and the Dar al-Islam, the land of the Muslims. I suppose the term Dar al-Islam would be the Muslim counterpart to our word Christendom. But that word is pretty antiquated, too. The concept of Christendom hasn't played much of a role in the Western psyche since the Poles and Germans turned back the Turkish armies at the Siege of Vienna in 1683, the last time a Muslim power was ever a serious threat to the West. That seems to be the story with a lot of the words that translators use to render the language of Islamic fundamentalism. They have a musty medieval sound. When somebody talks about infidels, I have an image of the characters in Ivanhoe who are always slipping off to the Holy Land to fight the Saracen infidel. In modern English, it isn't a word that we ever use in earnest. People may style themselves infidels to suggest their defiance of some ruling orthodoxy. But it's a sign of how thoroughly our culture has been secularized that not even Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson would use the word infidel to describe non-believers, whatever their sexual orientation. It's like calling somebody a pagan or heathen. It makes you sound like a sergeant major out of a Kipling story. That was the weirdest thing about Falwell's rant about all the people who had brought the September 11th attacks down on America's head. He said it was the fault of the pagans, the abortionists, the feminists, the gays and lesbians, and the ACLU. To most Americans, that word pagans was a tip-off that Falwell wasn't simply being intolerant, he was living in some other century. In fact, the only time we still hear the word infidel used literally is when it's put into the mouths of swarthy villains. That was what was so odd about hearing the word in the voiceover translation of Bin Laden's video. It sounded like something from a Pulp Fiction melodrama. Die, infidel dog. Infidel may have started its life as a homegrown English word, but it's ending its days as a translation. Whether it's ominous or comic, it isn't a notion we use ourselves. That's always the problem when you try to translate across a cultural divide. The words may be there, but they echo differently in the other person's room. The difficulty can cut both ways. A couple of weeks ago, the White House had to apologize when President Bush offhandedly described the war on terrorism as a crusade. Americans use that word without paying much attention to its origins, and we tend to forget that it has the root for cross buried in it, particularly when our Latin is shaky. But in Arabic, crusade translates as al-hamalat as-salibiyah, or campaign of the cross, and it can still evoke some vivid historical memories. It was disconcerting to hear Bin Laden throw the term back in an utterly literal way, referring to Bush as a big crusader. For us, that's a word you apply to a courageous politician, a cartoon rabbit, or a World War II British tank. It all underscores the problem that the U.S. faces as it tries to persuade the Muslim world that it isn't engaged in a religious war. And it's all the more difficult because, in a certain sense, it is a religious war, as Andrew Sullivan was arguing in an article in the New York Times last week. Not a war between Christendom and the Dar al-Islam, but between modernity and traditionalism. And deeper than that, between two visions of salvation, one secular and the other fundamentalist. You wonder how there could be any accommodation or understanding between the two sides when they hear the same words so differently. But if communication is difficult, you want to believe that it isn't hopeless. A couple of days ago, I was talking about Bush's crusade gaffe with a friend who teaches medieval Arabic history. Actually, she told me, if you wanted to do justice to crusade the way Bush used the word, you wouldn't translate it with the Arabic phrase that means campaign of the cross. You'd use that word jihad. Jihad does have the meaning of a religious war. But like crusade, it can also mean any kind of personal moral struggle. These days, she said, my jihad is being department vice chair. That made the word jihad sound a little less alien to me, and with it, the corner of the Muslim mind that it inhabits. You wonder if the worlds are really so different that there can't be any translation between them. It reminded me of what a translator told me once. Verbatim translations tend to sound odd, particularly when they have to bridge a vast cultural gulf. But if you root around, you'll usually find some other word that suggests a common point of understanding. If you're a translator, he said, you have to believe that when it comes to the crunch, people can always find something to talk about. And sometimes the translation that takes people at their literal word is the one that winds up being unfaithful.
Linguist Jeff Nunberg is the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now, Commentaries on Language and Culture from NPR's Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We know you have a lot on your mind right now, so it may seem like a strange time for us to be asking for money to support public radio. But we've had this fundraiser plan for a long time. If we didn't go through with it and ask for your support now, we'd be unable to bring you the coverage you want and need. So we trust that you'll understand, and we hope that you'll call with a pledge. Today is the 50th anniversary of the premiere of I Love Lucy, the CBS series that helped define the TV sitcom. David Bianculli looks back at a more innocent era.
Thursday Night on the Agency, a CBS drama series about the CIA, there's a fictional drama about terrorists threatening to unleash an epidemic of anthrax. Tomorrow night on the CBS Navy drama JAG, one of the main characters is trapped in an American consulate building in another country that's overtaken by force. Tonight on Third Watch, the NBC drama series about New York City firefighters, police, and emergency health workers, the usual scripted stories and fictional characters are being set aside. Instead, the show is offering a 2-hour documentary special letting real New York City rescue workers tell their own stories about September 11th. But also tonight, on TV Land, Lucy and Ethel try to con Ricky and Fred into taking them to a nightclub. Is it any wonder, in these times when even entertainment on television can be so somber, that I Love Lucy? Looking at I Love Lucy now is like cuddling up with a warm blanket. The problems are never more serious than a burnt pot roast or a hugely expanding loaf of bread. Everything is familiar and comforting. Ricky's, "Hi, honey, I'm home," Lucy's childlike cry, and another scheme by Lucy that backfires big time. Like the time she sneaks her way into doing a live commercial for a vitamin supplement on a show hosted by Ricky, only to be knocked for a loop by the syrup's high alcohol content during several rehearsal tastings.
Are you tired of running down a listless? Do you pop out at parties? Are you unpopular? Well, are you? The answer to all your problems is in this little old bottle. Vitamin and Vegemin. Vitamins and meat and vegetables and minerals. So why don't you join the thousands of happy peppy people and get a great big bottle of Vita Vidi Vidi Meeny Mighty Mo.
It's funny to think that 50 years ago, I Love Lucy was cutting-edge television in so many respects. It was the first TV series in which the central married couple were from different ethnic backgrounds. Desi Arnaz, Lucille Ball's real-life husband, was Cuban, and so was Lucy's bandleader husband, Ricky. It was the first TV series to show its character pregnant, again mirroring real life since Lucille Ball was expecting at the time, when even the word pregnant couldn't be used on television. And because Lucy and Desi wanted to produce I Love Lucy on the West Coast rather than in New York, they ended up pioneering a whole new method of mounting a situation comedy. Instead of broadcasting it live, they filmed it, using multiple cameras to capture the action simultaneously. It was a technique borrowed from Art Linkletter, who used it to capture kids saying the darndest things. And it worked so well that it remains the basic template for the three-camera sitcom 50 years later. The show was a huge hit from the start, and left TV only because Lucy and Desi wanted to stop it as TV's number one show, something only a handful of series have done in the entire history of television. It had a great number of classic bits and episodes, many of which can be seen this week in TV Land's nightly marathon salute. Tonight, in fact, the marathon kicks off with the very first episode of I Love Lucy, broadcast at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, exactly 50 years to the minute from the time it first aired on CBS. It's televised almost as it was then, except for some alterations in the original animation and presentation that had to do with the show's original sponsor, Philip Morris. Those changes are explained during the commercial breaks by TV Land president Larry Jones.
As you can see from these brief selections, the original open to the show featured animated Lucy and Ricky figures and a pack of cigarettes. That pack was an element of the show's interstitials and the closing credits as well. The opening included a spokesman pitching the product, and this mid-show break was a testimonial commercial shot in Las Vegas.
I'd like you to try a simple test. Do you mind?
Not at all.
Well, first, let me offer you a Philip Morris cigarette. There we are.
While our intention was to recreate this historic half hour of television, we certainly hope you understand the changes we made. We
now return. The rest of the show, though, is pure Lucy. We've come a long way in 50 years. But sometimes, and this is one of those times, it's nice to be able to go back.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharuk directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Hassan Astane, a structural engineer who is being funded by the National Science Foundation to study the remains of the World Trade Center and analyze how the towers collapsed after the attack. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.